MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's that time of the week. It is a Tuesday afternoon, and we look forward to having our chat with our regular chat with Dr. Ross Walker. He joins me on the phone. Hi, Ross.
G'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, we're getting there, mate. We are getting there. I've got a quick one from a listener, and she says, would you mind asking that lovely man, Dr. Ross Walker?
Oh, what a wonderful person.
What he recommends for the booster after having the Novavax vaccinations. That's from Marilyn.
Yeah, I think another Novavax, if she's had that before. I was on Melbourne and Adelaide radio yesterday talking about the AFL player in Adelaide, Ollie Wines, who I think plays for Port Adelaide. I'm not sure an AFL person. I think that AFL is a genetic disease for people born south of the Murray, but that aside, he was taken from the field with shortness of breath, palpitations, dizziness, with some temporal relationship to having had an RNA vaccine. And there were suggestions that it was the vaccine that caused his symptoms. Now, it may well have been so, and I made the point that I've probably seen 40 people over the past 9 months who, within 6 weeks of having typically Pfizer, have developed chest pain, shortness of breath, palpitations, dizziness. But when you examine their heart with an echocardiogram, they have completely normal heart function. So they don't have the reported myocarditis, which occurs probably at a serious level in about 1 to 2 people per 100,000 and probably around 10 people per 100,000 for men below the age of 30. But COVID does 10 times that. So COVID is a much greater cause of myocarditis. And so I've said to people who are concerned about potentially having a reaction to Pfizer or Moderna, we have two perfectly good vaccines in AstraZeneca and Novavax. Have those.
Okay. Now, look, this is another question from John. It's basically referring to your comments last week in reference to the mRNA shots. He said, are the cases of the subacute myocarditis you were seeing in mainly young men or all age groups? And are other cardiologists seeing the same things?
Well, firstly, I don't know because I work in my own practice and I don't work in hospitals, so I don't talk to my colleagues about this. But I know a lot of cardiologists are seeing people who are complaining of these symptoms. And I've seen people across the board. I've seen people in their 50s, 60s and 70s complain of chest discomfort, shortness of breath, palpitations after the RNA vaccines. But it's not proven that they have myocarditis. It's just that they have symptoms. Now, that could be what we call the nocebo effect. So we've heard of the placebo effect. So the placebo is you come to me, I give you a sugar pill, I tell you it's a very strong pill for whatever condition. I've got a 40% chance of that working because of the placebo effect. The nocebo effect, and this is found to be very common, say, for example, with statin drugs, where people know that statins may cause aches and pains in people. You give a statin to somebody, the chance of them getting aches and pains is much higher because of this nocebo effect. But also, in some cases, it does cause aches and pains. So when you're given a vaccine and you've heard of all of these reactions people have had, there is the possibility of this nocebo effect from the vaccination. That's the first point. But let me give you an anecdote. This is not a clinical trial. This is just one personal case I saw a couple of weeks ago. A 48-year-old man rang my radio show a few months ago and said that 5 weeks after he received his second Pfizer dose, Pfizer vaccination, he was out. He was a pretty intense cyclist, and he did a really heavy cycling burst on this particular day and developed typical cardiac-sounding chest pain, went to the hospital, had a high troponin, which is an indication of cardiac damage. They did an angiogram. They did coronary calcium scoring. It was all completely normal. Told him there was nothing wrong with him. He went home. He said, oh, fine. A couple of days later, felt well, so he thought he'd do his own stress test on himself. So again, did a very heavy cycle, more chest pain, back to the hospital, more troponin rise. So that may have had nothing to do with Pfizer. It was 5 weeks before, or equally, it might have been what I'm talking about, this potential subacute myocarditis. But when I looked at his heart, when he came in to see me, it was completely normal. So there is no good medical evidence that this is happening. I'm just giving you the anecdotal experience of one cardiologist sitting in his own practice, seeing 40 people who've had the vaccination and within 5 to 6 weeks, it could be a few days later, it could be a few weeks later, I have seen a number of people complaining of symptoms, but I have not seen one case of the full-blown myocarditis where the heart isn't pumping properly after the vaccination. I've seen a handful of cases of pericarditis where the covering gets inflamed as well. But look, the key message here is that hundreds of thousands of people have been given these RNA vaccinations around the world and they've not come to any harm at all, but it has prevented them getting COVID. Equally, hundreds of thousands of people have received AstraZeneca, probably less received Novavax, with minimal problems. But the key problem is it's prevented them dying by about a factor of 90% from COVID and also from being hospitalised by a factor of about 90%. So all the vaccinations are highly effective at preventing the real problem, which is COVID, not the vaccinations.
Another one from Kevin. Kevin says, I know I haven't sent you these, but I'm sorry, they've only come in late, but you're hot to trot.
That's right.
So you're good at this.
Done it before.
You have, haven't you? For a few years.
Yeah, once or twice.
Just a little bit of experience. I was wondering if you could tell me more on triglycerides divided by HDL ratio. I've read it's quite predictive of cardiac events and also determining the size of LDL particle size. That's from Kevin. That's a very, very involved question there, Kevin.
It's a very well-educated question, and thank you, Kevin, for the question. Now, what we're talking about here, and I've been saying this for a long time to you, Brent, and a long time on radio and to my patients, that everyone thinks about LDL being bad and HDL being good as far as cholesterol goes. That is simplistic nonsense. LDL and HDL are divided into small bits and large bits, and here's where size is important. The small bits are bad, the large bits are good. And so what you want to do is generate more large LDL, more large HDL. So the triglyceride to HDL ratio, which we like to be less than one, is a good indicator of whether you have more large or small LDL. So if your triglyceride HDL ratio is above one, then you're at more risk of having small LDL, which is the thing that puts fat in your arteries. So for example, someone might have a cholesterol of 7 with an HDL of 2.5, which is the so-called good cholesterol, and a low triglyceride. And that's a very balanced profile. They typically have zero calcium scores and you can ignore their cholesterol.
Right.
But they're the ones that doctors will often throw a statin at.
Okay.
But then you've got people who come with a cholesterol of 4.5, a triglyceride of 2, and an HDL of 0.7, and the doctor says, oh, your cholesterol's pretty good. No, it's not. That's small LDL cholesterol. Because of the high triglyceride, low HDL, it's a marker for small LDL cholesterol. So Kevin's question is a very, very important one, and it really gets to the mark of what is the cause of 70% of heart disease, which is the insulin resistance gene that sets you up for diabetes, for high blood pressure, high triglyceride, low HDL, or therefore an increased triglyceride to HDL ratio, and fat around the belly. All of this part of the insulin resistance syndrome, which leads to what we call metabolic syndrome, which is the commonest genetic abnormality in the world. It affects 30% of Caucasians, 50% of Asians, and 100% of people with darker or olive skin. And that's the major cause of cardiovascular disease. 70% of the cause, 20% is the lipoprotein delay that I talk about all the time.
Yeah, okay. That's it. Thank you very much. Let's talk about some of the things that you send me. This nasal spray, a newly discovered small molecule, they say, can be sprayed into people's noses to prevent COVID-19 illness. Now, this is prior to exposure and provide early treatment if administered soon after infection. So far, they've only done trials, am I right, in mice, not
that's
in
it.
Humans.
Yep.
That's the next phase.
That's the next phase, and it's a small molecule. There was absolutely zero side effects in the mice that were given the molecule, and you know it's very experimental because it doesn't have a name. It has a number to it. It's N0385 is the number of this thing, and it's just, as you say, a small molecule sprayed intranasally either prior to exposure or within 12 hours of exposure in a few single daily doses and completely prevented COVID in the mice who were exposed to COVID after they were given this nasal treatment. So it's pretty exciting stuff, and with all things COVID, this will be fast-tracked into human trials and potentially will be a widespread treatment, and maybe not just for COVID, but maybe for the common cold and even influenza. Who knows yet?
New research, again in mice, for the first time draws a casual connection between changes in the gut microbiome to behavioural and cognitive changes in animal model of Alzheimer's disease. Now, you wrote an interesting paper on this, which you sent me. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because over the past few decades, we've really spoke about how important it is to have good gut health and its relationship to many other diseases, which is what I said in the paper. And so we know there's now a clear link between gut health, immune disease, cardiovascular disease, autoimmune diseases, a lot of rheumatologic conditions and things like ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. But this particular paper just looked at the link between alterations in the gut microbiome and Alzheimer's disease. So in a healthy gut, wait for this, we've got over 100 trillion bacteria living in our gut. And in fact, human beings are 90% bacteria, 10% human cells. So we're mainly bacteria. So if you've got healthy bacteria, which typically in a healthy person is 85% as opposed to 15% the pathogenic bacteria, and because there's much more healthy guys than the healthy guys keep the bad guys under control. But if you have an alteration in your gut bacteria, that can cause all sorts of issues. So there were three particular studies that were presented at a recent conference in the UK looking at this gut-brain connection. And the first one looked at the types of gut bacteria found in Alzheimer's disease and found that those people who had Alzheimer's disease had a completely different microbiome or set of gut bacteria than people who were normal. The second paper was a mouse study, and they basically looked at three different types of mice, the normal mice, the control group, and then the two different types of mice who had genetic predispositions to Alzheimer's. And then what they did was gave these different mice fecal transplants from humans that had Alzheimer's disease and showed that in all cases there was a significant problem with thinking in the mice soon after they were given the fecal transplants, much worse than the other two groups who were genetically predisposed, suggesting that if you have a genetic predisposition to this, you're going to do much worse off with bad gut bacteria. And finally, they took the blood from people with Alzheimer's disease and added to brain stem cells in the laboratory and found that there were factors in the bloodstream of people with Alzheimer's disease that impaired the ability of the stem cells to grow new nerves. So it's a really interesting concept to think that what's going on in your gut may affect what's going on in your brain. We know that this is not just the case for Alzheimer's, but also for things like Parkinson's disease as well. So it's a really interesting area that potentially in the future, it may be fixing up our gut microbiome may reduce our risk for getting Alzheimer's disease as we age.
How do you test your gut microbiome? Is there a test that you can do?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't think we've answered that one, because you see, you could just give one stool sample, and you're just having a bad gut microbiome day on that particular day. So you might just sample a bit of your stool where you've got more pathogenic bacteria. So I think at this stage we haven't as yet reached a really good way of testing for how healthy people's gut microbiome is. But the surrogate way they're doing it at the moment is just taking stool samples from people. But I think it's probably best if you're going to do it to take a few samples over a month or so, and that's not practical in the real world. But they're certainly doing that in research studies, looking at all of this. And I'm the president of the Gut Foundation for a reason I still haven't figured out. And one of the people who's on the board is a fellow called Professor Imad El Omar, who's the professor of gastroenterology at St. George Hospital. He's also the editor of the famous journal Gut, and he's a world expert in the microbiome. So I'm going to put all these questions to him at our next board meeting, because I don't think we're as yet doing this well, and I think we need to do it better so we can give people a better handle on, firstly, what's going on in their gut, but secondly, what can we do about it? And a lot of people don't realise that just by having two or three pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day, you say, well, it's easy. If it's easy, how come less than 10% of people do it? They're the people who have the healthiest gut microbiome. So because we're eating all this processed, packaged crap masquerading as food, we're losing the quality of our gut microbiome. So the pathogenic bacteria are growing into our colons and chewing up all this crappy food we're eating, as opposed to the fruit and vegetables which feed the healthy gut microbiome and keep our body healthy. And people who do the 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables, have the lowest rates of heart disease and cancer, as one example, in the community.
I'm just thinking about what you've said, and basically in a nutshell, and I'm paraphrasing, we all know we should eat 2 to 3 pieces of fruit and 3 to 5 vegetables, but so many people don't do that,
yep,
right?
That's it.
Are there supplements people can take that will help the gut microbiome
because
you don't do that?
Yes, there are, but they're not as good as the fruit and vegetables. It's better to have the whole foods than it is to go for a supplement. But there are things we call probiotics. Everyone's heard of probiotics, mm-hmm, which are a huge amount of gut bacteria. So you're talking in the billions of lactobacillus and bifidobacteria, all the good ones. My favourite gut bacteria, we all have a favourite one, of course. My favourite gut bacteria is Akkermansia mucinophilia, which only lives in the colon of thin people, doesn't live in fat people's colons. And there's been some experiments where they gave mice the Akkermansia mucinophilia, obese mice, and they lost weight. So it's the potential of possibly putting that into a probiotic to help people lose weight. And also there's prebiotics, which is feeding healthy bacteria good foods like soluble fibers, and things like onion and garlic have a lot of prebiotics. And they're even now talking about postbiotics, which are the healthy chemicals, a thing we call short-chain fatty acids, that bacteria produce as well. So there's a lot of different things going on in this space, and we're getting closer to be able to developing personalised products for people to keep their gut bacteria healthy.
So we should talk more, or there should be something published about, you know, a good gut microbiome diet.
No, absolutely, yeah. But this is what people around the world are working on now. But we do know a good gut microbiome diet is what we're being told about what is a good diet. Avoid crappy foods, yeah, which is processed, packaged muck in a box, and have natural, healthy, fresh foods, especially fruit and vegetables.
I'm going to get into trouble. I've got to take a break. It's always good talking to you. It's so easy to talk to you. We'll take a break. We'll come back, continue our chat with Dr. Ross Walker shortly.